Welcome to the Ideal Investor Show. This is the podcast where we help you challenge your mindset and discover where you are. Tired of stories about other people's success? We can help you change your life, determine your time freedom point, and join us on the journey to financial success. Let's go.
Hello and welcome everybody to another episode of the Ideal Investor Show, where we tell you and talk to you about how can you most efficiently use and invest your funds. And today we have a great guest. Kyle Mowry is with us today and is going to help us understand what kind of options do we have to diversify our portfolio. So welcome to the show, Kyle.
Yes, thank you for having me. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, absolutely. We are very glad to have you, and especially because you are in an area of investing and funding and money and so forth that we don't have access all the time. But before we go there, tell us a little bit, how did you end up in the current situation that you're in, the kind of work that you're doing? What is kind of the origin story for Kyle and how he got to where he is?
Yeah, no, thank you. So I was a student athlete growing up and played baseball in college. But an athlete only has a finite shelf life in terms of as a career. And so, being a person who enjoyed competition and whatnot, I found the financial markets wildly interesting. And then I read some of the fundamental books of value investing and fundamental investing, such as, Margin of Safety by Seth Klarman or Intelligent Investor, some of these, and it just clicked. It's, value investing, either it's like a shot, it either takes right away or it doesn't take at all. So,
right. Yeah, you're right. So I guess you were saying you didn't get that $700 million deal that I just read about?
Yes. No, Shohei is wonderful. Deferred for tax reasons. I don't know if you saw that part of the contract, but
yeah, I saw that 10 years, 700 million. I'm like, wow. I mean, it's kind of amazing. That tells a little bit to the audience, and I think they know it anyway. I'm not a spring chicken anymore. I've been around for quite a while. And even 70 million, 70 was considered a huge deal, but 700, I might have a chance to get old enough to see that an athlete gets a $1 billion deal. So it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, it's certainly both a pitcher and a hitter. That is very, very unique.
Right, but it's still also a unique amount of money, don't you think?
Sure, but you're getting both, so.
Yeah, so now let's get a little bit Grizzly Capital and tell us how that came together and what are you actually doing there?
Yeah, so I founded the business after business school, Grizzly Rock Capital, 12 years ago. We're based in Chicago. I manage private funds in the small cap space, both long short strategy and long only. Because they're private funds, I can't disclose performance or whatnot. But let me just say it this way. We're still around after 12 years, going strong and going in the right direction. So very happy to talk about, what we see in fundamental small cap landscape and how it might, be additive to investors' portfolios as an asset class.
Okay, yeah, we can talk about that in a minute. One thing maybe for our audience, can you explain a little bit when you say private money, what that means? Is that like a family office or just below that, or where would that be positioned, so to speak?
Yes, so we are an SEC registered investment advisor. However, our funds are private. The term would be hedge fund. So we cannot broadly discuss performance or whatnot. So I'm not here, talking about the funds. I'm here just talking about small caps and kind of what we're seeing and, the industry landscape.
Right. And so who would be the kind of people who would actually invest with you?
Yeah, we do have a number of family office investors, a number of small institutions, and a significant number of high net worth, private investors. Yeah.
That's cool. And then before we go into the details of the assets directly, is there a minimum that, for the audience, if they were to say, okay, what Kyle is describing is really interesting in the context of diversifying my portfolio, is there a minimum that they should be aware of?
Definitely in the, 250,000 plus type range. But yeah, you can speak with our head of business communication on that sort of thing. So.
Okay, right. Well, I just, I like to have people have an idea what the investment volume would look like. So You said you mainly like to talk about small caps and where the markets are going. So tell me where you would like to kind of enter into that world.
Sure. So I think it's a, you know, diversification is really the only free lunch in investing. And yeah. That can be across asset classes, that can be across market cap ranges, that can, you know, stocks and bonds and commodities and real estate and then private assets, private equity, private credit, hedge funds, et cetera. They do, you know, the less correlated those return streams are, the better off you're going to be in a mean variance portfolio. So I think small cap is something that has gotten a bad rap or at least underperformed. Small caps have done, you know, fine on an absolute basis, but relative to things like the Magnificent Seven, some of the NASDAQ related indices the last, say, decade, small caps have underperformed dramatically. And just because they've underperformed dramatically doesn't mean that that will be what it is the next 10 years. Obviously, I don't have a crystal ball, neither does anyone else. Yet it is very interesting to see certain, you know, certain businesses or certain investments within there that have significant free cash flow yields, you know, owners' earnings in the teens and growing in a non-cyclical manner with respect to new products, new technologies, et cetera. So a lot of times when people think small cap, they think poorly run companies and or, you know, certain, you know, over-indexed to commodities such as oil and gas and or real estate or potentially even a banking, small cap banks or whatnot. And they feel like they have to be a specialist to do that. I don't really think that's the case. I think that, you know, in small caps, whether you use an index or an active manager, I think there are, you know, unique opportunities to, at the right time, you know, deliver significant alpha and return from the asset class.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, for the audience, can you kind of give a little bit of a distinction between small, medium, and large cap?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's fairly fuzzy. I got into the business.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, anything under $1 billion of market cap was small cap. Now, I think that, I don't know what the technical definition is. Probably 2.5, 3 billion. Mid caps probably into that 5 to 7 billion range, and then large above that. Most of the names that everyone knows would be, you know, mega caps. So Netflix, Microsoft, Apple, these.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, the other part is there is obviously a difference between the valuation based on stock price versus what the business is actually doing or what the turnover slash revenue is and stuff like that, right? Like, I mean, I am, for example, and I know this is one of the Magnificent Seven is Tesla, and that's one of the few stocks I have. And if you look at the, I think like close to 800 million, if you take the stock valuation, but 800 billion, that doesn't mean that they turn over 800 billion anywhere near, you know, like even on a multi-year basis. So I think the PE is like, or EPS is like 100 or something close to it right now.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, that is an important delineation. Now, I mean, I had to chuckle a little bit because I saw some work from somebody recently about the S&P 500. And if you take the Magnificent Seven out, then it's really only been doing 6% for the other 493 stocks. Now, are there particular industry areas where you would say that is the part of the market that is kind of like underappreciated or something like that?
I think sometimes the least sexy industries, some of the have not, you know, been splashed across the pages of the Wall Street Journal for the last few years, you know, largely that's large cap tech, quality as a style factor. These businesses have priced very well. But there's other things in, you know, say, take an old line industrial company that is trading at a cheap price, generating a, you know, double digit free cash flow yield. To, you know, owners' earnings and potentially there's a dividend, potentially they're buying back stock. You get a situation where they're developing new products, new technologies, and, you know, the earnings should inflect upwards. I would argue that that might be a very interesting investment over the next few years because you have, you know, the confluence of a low entry price, high free cash flow, and then earnings growth. That's a recipe for success Now, whether it's, you know, 2024 or 2025 or beyond, you know, a little bit harder to know, especially if we get into a recession. However, you know, that that free cash flow and earnings generation of the business, plus the growth of new products, that can be a cacophony of, you know, value for folks paying a reasonably low price now to get in, to get into the investment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one thing, and I'm not talking about it very often, but besides doing the work for Ideal Wealth Grower and the Ideal Investor Show that we're on right now, I'm also still and have been for the last 20 years by now a consultant in the life science and pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, I was fascinated. I just finished reading a book called The Code Breakers by Walter Isaacson about the lady that won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of the CRISPR technology. I don't know if you're familiar, but it's basically how you can fix things in the human genome that didn't come out correctly. Like one thing that I just saw in the news is that the FDA gave approval for one of those CRISPR companies that is treating sickle cell, which is basically a thing that is afflicting millions of people in the world, especially in Africa and African Americans and stuff like that. So I know that typically to develop anything, because I'm in the industry for many years, it's not uncommon to have like 100, 150 million venture capital in, needed to ever get to like through the human trials and then finally into the actual approval for the market. How about that? Because I think that in this kind of gene technology area and in any variations, it's a pretty broad field within life sciences. What's your thinking about that as a field to consider for small cap?
That's a great question. I think with respect to industries that require deep domain knowledge, I have always sort of said, you know, you want to be with an industry specialist. Healthcare, right. Pharma, and especially biotech, there are specialist funds that do a great job. We're not one of them. So I'm not you know, versed in those companies, and I don't have an opinion on them in terms of specific companies or specific valuations, but there are definitely industry specialists out there and they can really augment portfolios. If you look at the way that the institutional investors are allocating their capital in hedge funds, they tend to lean into industry specialists. And I think especially in mid-cap and large-cap, that makes a lot of sense, right? And because there is a plethora of opportunities and folks with backgrounds such as yours, it would make sense that they would focus on pharma or healthcare in a way that, you know, folks with backgrounds such as mine in small caps, it's just not in our circle of competence. So we focus on other, you know, really interesting and unique businesses. But yeah, I there's a number of specialists in that area that would, I'm sure, provide nice returns over time.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I mean, one of the things that I'm thinking about, and that's why I earlier asked you, you know, how big of a company size are you looking at when you're delineating between small, medium, and large cap? And a lot of these are definitely in the small cap space until, you know, they get their approval. And even then, until there's real adoption of whatever they have come up with, it probably takes 3 to 5 years from FDA approval before you can really talk about a home run. I, for example, always am a big advocate, both in our real estate investing advisory, but in general, that people should look at things that they are interested in or competent or, if possible, both, like you just said. Like I like, for example, to read the articles and the research that Cathie Wood's ARK Invest is putting out, not because I'm an investor with them, because it's basically great information for free, most of it, right? To be able to say, okay, I know something about this particular field and I can find information that others have generated that is typically very well researched and database and data driven, and then go to, you know, the Kyles of the world and say, hey, how about doing something like that with part of my money?
Yeah, there's mostly large cap, so I don't overlap a lot with their firm, but yeah, it's a similar process. Understand the product, understand the earnings power of the business, define your duration. I think something like ARK, I think the duration and where they're looking at the free cash flow is quite a ways down the road. You know, fundamental investors or value investors, it tends to be more near term. So for us, it's, you know, 2 to 4 years. We're looking for that inflection. So we are not a typical hedge fund trading to quarter or whatnot. But we are very much fundamental, but looking for those, the earnings and free cash flow inflection over the next couple of years. And that's just a fundamentally different strategy than, say, an ARK. So we kind of tend to play in different pools, even of public securities.
Absolutely. And I didn't mean to say that somebody should go to ARK and invest with them. It's just they really provide very good research. Okay. So if you were to tell somebody or had your opinion, your advice from a diversification, what kind of areas and percentages would you recommend from your perspective?
The way I would think about it is what is truly diversified, right? If you have a whole bunch of large cap stocks, they're probably somewhat correlated. If you're largely in one segment of real estate investing in one state or a handful or even a regional geography, that's fairly concentrated, right? But if you're looking at small caps as less correlated to other asset classes or standalone as an absolute value kind of generator, I think there are definitely many, many funds you can just do an index very simply and cheaply. That's also tax efficient. There's also quantitative methods in small cap. For example, Tobias Carlyle Greenbacked has some excellent products. I'm not affiliated in any way. Or there's active managers, and there's a plethora of active managers too, both in a mutual fund, ETF format or on the private side, such as us. But I think that looking at small cap and looking at what might it do over the next 5+ years is something that, you know, that's the reason that many of our investors are with us. And that's, you know, something that I think could benefit many, many portfolios now.
I agree with you on that totally. One quick thing, obviously you have these different areas of assets is what I would call them, right? You can say, okay, I go in stocks or have assets or investments in real estate. When it comes to the type, you know, like I'm, for example, if somebody were to ask me, and obviously I think we're both pretty biased in the direction that we are most of the time going, I would want to have our clients literally own real estate, have some gold and silver coins, have some crypto or some other alternative assets, and then some stock. And the percentage breakdown is obviously based on the bias, I would say. So outside of stock investing, do you advise or suggest any kind of other asset, not the types, but the way to hold it, similar along the lines I was just describing?
So that's our business is really a rifle shot focus in small cap securities. So when people come and ask about asset allocation, I say, well, first of all, that's not really our business. I will say, though, that with the return of interest rates for US-based folks, you know, if you can get 5% for 2 years, that's not a terrible return, right? In a liquid, just a T-bill. I've been, you know, a lot of my clients have said, well, you know, what do you think about T-bills? I said, yeah, I think, you know, especially if you're looking at something that's economically sensitive, you know, we may or may not have a recession here. But 5% return nominal, I think that's for at least a part of the assets is something that is available now that just wasn't available a couple of years ago. So that I think is something that is coming back in vogue of people holding cash and getting a reasonable nominal return.
Exactly. And I mean, we're using it, for example, in the context of reserves, right? Because as somebody is building their portfolio, regardless what exactly the content of the portfolio is, there's always a risk that something can go wrong, especially like when you hold real asset like houses or real estate or condominiums and apartments and stuff like that. So if for whatever reason you need a certain amount of cash, and one thing that's kind of interesting, you can on the one hand, like you just said, get 5 or 6% for 2 years, and then you can get an 18 to 24 month credit card for 0%, right? And so basically you pay with a credit card for 0%, and then when your 2 year 5% thing comes out, you can basically replenish it and you got the money for free and made some interest.
The math makes sense. The logistics, something to do, but yeah.
Well, before, like you said, that I'm only mentioning it in follow-up to what you were saying, because before that, any of those kind of thoughts or even, you know, trying to do something like that was just literally the math didn't work because it wasn't available, right? And so nowadays you can actually diversify in more directions. I wouldn't necessarily recommend buying bonds or stuff, but you can do some, you know, even with CDs and stuff where you can get pretty amazing deals. So I think that the point is, and that's always been my argument in all these podcasts, I'm always very grateful to have guests like you, Kyle, because the point is to say, okay, how can we educate and make resources like you available to the audience? And then anybody and everybody has to make their own decision of what they want to do exactly and who they want to work with. I'm obviously hoping they work with you and me, but there's plenty of other people who have great expertise. So if somebody were interested to learn a little more how this stuff works with small caps, how do they get in touch with you?
You can email us info@grizzlyrockcapital.com. It's right on the website. It must be an accredited investor for us to work together, but we can qualify that. And there's a lot of, you know, just speaking broadly about small caps, there are a lot of mutual funds, a lot of good resources in the public domain. So as folks think about asset allocation and consider, you know, the next couple of years may look different than the last few years. And it's possible that, you know, that big tech keeps going. Who knows? But in terms of overall asset allocation and what may or may not be attractive, I think that's certainly something to look at.
Absolutely. I mean, my opinion on that is selectivity and really, really making an effort to understand what you're investing into. I believe that's really more important now than probably, at least in my investing lifetime. It's not even, I believe, necessarily a matter of industry. It's a matter of the individual organizations. How well can you really find out what they're doing and how likely is what they're doing going to be successful in the economic environment that is developing or is currently upon us? I think we are in, at least for myself, I would say, I can't remember having ever lived in such a transitional period, not just, you know, one thing like the internet is coming or smartphones are coming or stuff like that, but really on a geopolitical aspect, on a monetary aspect thing. And so there's so many things all seemingly going on simultaneously and all having, at least appears to me, more impact potentially in the future than what we had gotten used to in the last 10 years. So it's definitely very interesting times.
Yep, I could not agree more.
Okay, wonderful. So let's come to the two questions I ask everybody, independent of investing and so forth. The first one being, Kyle, if you could meet anybody, past or present, who would it be and why?
Well, the answer is a, you know, as a personal matter, I'm a person of faith in Jesus Christ. So I would go back a few thousand years, and I would find that wildly fascinating to interact with or speak to someone whose words I've studied for a while now. So that would be interesting. Just, and even if you're not a person of faith or you're a person of a different faith, just the impact on history and across the globe, it would be an interesting historical occasion.
Okay, yeah, that's very cool. There are obviously a whole bunch of authors who wrote the book, right? It would be kind of cool to talk to them and find out why they wrote it the way they wrote it. Now, that may or may not answer the second question, but you can pick an alternative if you want, because the second question is, if you had a time machine, where would you go and why?
Oh, time machine. Well, yes, I'd probably wrap it together. I do think that there would be a, you know, going back to such an interesting period for the world, World War II, or some of the, as the Roman Empire was building out, that would be interesting to see the world as it was developing, things we've studied in history, but that would be kind of interesting.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I feel like when you look at history books, at least I remember the ones that we had in school, you know, they had periods of like 100 years, maybe on one page, something like that. And, you know, having been around for a little while, at least I know that there has been so much happening in my lifetime. I would like to go back to some of those pages and say, okay, what was really going on in that century?
Yeah,
and that would be very fascinating. So yeah, I'm with you. Maybe if they ever come up with a time machine, you and I can go together. All right, Kai, it was a great pleasure to having you on the show and talking to you and giving our audience a little bit of an idea about small caps. I want to really thank you for that and hope we can do it again.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.